Today we have the Gerard de Polpitz, and he's currently the professor at the Indian University, right? And I realize the also that he has affiliation at the IQC, partially because of his long-term collaboration with CDA and also the contribution to the conservation. So as I mentioned, his research topics covers both condensed matter physics and the quantum information. And typically in quantum information, also the he worked on various topics, if I remember. One is the generalized entanglement with the Howard Baumann, and also the Roland Sommer here, and also the he worked on the NMR simulation. And also the recently also the, he studied about the stability or the relativity of the topological system. Mm-hmm. And today he's going to talk about the unified approach to quantum and classical.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It's always a pleasure to come here and talk to the people.
So let me tell you what is today's talk. So I'm planning basically to report on very, very recent results that we got on dualities together with my graduate student, Emilio Cubanera, and with Professor Sohan Nusino from Washington University. This is basically one of those topics in physics that always fascinated me, intrigued me, and at the same time bothered me a lot because of the lack of very precise definition of what duality is. Okay, duality is full of examples everywhere, but to me it has been extremely hard to pin down exactly what's the main thing about duality, what is behind the concept of duality. So indeed, duality permeates in all disciplines of physics. Okay, you can name it. You will see it in kinetic physics, condensed matter, statistical mechanics, field theory, everywhere. And indeed, one of the messages of this talk, will be that many times, just by looking at a certain problem from a completely fresh and new perspective, many times it can give you new insight to solve. Not only attack, but also solve some questions that otherwise seem untractable. Okay, and we will see some example of that. For example, indeed, in the context of topological quantum order, we've seen this beta historical model that, in principle, through a very simple duality, you can map the two Ising chains, and then you can solve exactly, basically, that problem at finite temperature. Something that, just from the usual representation, is extremely hard to see how to do. And of course, these things have a lot of consequence. Like, for example, the concept of thermal fragility started from there, because the concept of thermal fragility you can address exactly in that particular case. Okay, so that's one example where duality can be useful. Another example, indeed, that is in a completely different context, and I will talk at the very end. It's in the context of gauge field theories. Indeed, there have been some conjectures. Gauge field theories about, in particular, abelian gauge theories, CN gauge theories, about whether for n larger or equal to 5, basically you can have a self-dual theory or not. Okay, so of course, as we will see, it's extremely hard to answer this question in the context that it was formulated. However, in the context I will present you here, it's extremely easy to show that indeed. There is a self-duality for any, okay, it doesn't matter if it's n 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you name it, okay? So, but of course, you have to look at the problem from a completely different perspective to see that. So one of the things I also would like, another message I would like to mention is that this is in no way, something that is the ultimate truth of everything or the ultimate work of everything. This is just a starting point, okay? So this is like sort of Pandora box, I would say. From this my perspective, and if there is something I want to show you is that this talk probably will demystify all these ideas about dualities. So let me see, basically tell you a little bit about the state of affairs and what dualities are or have been basically in the literature, and indeed there are a few reviews on that, and one of the more interesting or at least highly cited ones is the one of Savi. It's a review of modern physics of the 80s, okay, that indeed is very interesting, is full of examples, and I have extracted from there some of these definitions that he's using there. You know, if you read the paper, we say dualities are certain mathematical transformations. Things, you know, okay, you know in principle that is something related to mathematical transformation, but you don't know exactly what it is, right? But then they are saying, well, let's be a little more precise. And when we are more precise, he would say, okay, transformations like the one considered by Kramers and Bagnier in the start of the isotope. Okay. So again, I mean, you see, there is, I mean, a little hope that just by looking at one particular example, you are going to figure out, okay, what is the depth of constant, okay? So, by the way, let me tell you, indeed, that paper is extremely deep. I'm not arguing for that. I'm just saying that if you want to go beyond what and answer certain questions, beyond what is usually advocated, it's extremely hard because you find this kind of far wall. Okay, anything is defined precisely. Okay, and it's not clear how to derive these dualities. Okay, it's extremely hard. It's not clear at all. Okay, it's a lot of art. Okay, and in particular, as we will see in a moment, it is extremely hard to, as I will show in a moment, to distinguish or relate the classical dualities from the quantum dualities. I mean, it looks like these are completely unrelated concepts. Okay. So indeed, what are dualities? Okay, and I will give you just a shorthand, you know, definition of what dualities is, or dualities are, that I will elaborate in the course of this talk. Okay, so indeed, you will see that these are nothing else than unitary maps of bone algebras. So I have to define indeed all these concepts. So we will go through that indeed. Now, why we care about these things? Of course, if they are mathematical transformations, I mean, in principle, this is just mathematics. I'm not a mathematician in particular. I'm a condensed matter physicist, so I'm interested in real applications. So why is I care about these things? Well, there are many, many reasons why we should care about these things. In particular, for example, in my particular field, I mean, we like to draw phase diagrams, okay? And many times, indeed, those systems, those models, they have certain, you know, dual relations to other models, and then is, you know, it's very handy when you have those relations to draw the phase diagram or draw the phase boundaries of those diagrams. Okay, this helps. And in many cases, okay, there is a very clear correlation between self-dual points of the theory and critical points. Okay, indeed, the example, Kramers-Bagnier, that I just mentioned before, is one of those examples where you knew the critical temperature of the two-dimensional IC model before the model was of exactly balanced iron. So you have information about the exact critical temperature before you did it. So it's, you know, it's a very useful thing. Now, indeed, there are other reasons. For example, as I will show you, indeed, this type of transformations allow you to understand what's the nature of the excitations, topological excitations, okay? Now, I put there a classification because it is not something finished, okay? But, of course, we would like to understand these unitary maps and, of course, classify this type of excitations, topological excitations, but we are still far from that. Well, in other fields, indeed, dualities are, this is basically condensed matter physics, okay? So, but in other fields, I mean, indeed, dualities are used to connect completely, in principle, unrelated theories, okay? Let me first give you an example that everyone probably doesn't know, okay, but I mean, I will mention because it's condensed matter, is the connection between orbital order models, like orbital compass model, and which is a model used to describe transition metal compounds, and superconducting theories, for example, P plus IP superconducting Schrodinger junctions, okay? So there is a model that is called Schumacher model, and indeed, these theories can be shown to be dual to each other, and they are dual through this kind of unitary mappings I'm talking about. And probably the best known, okay, the best known duality that, you know, probably you hear here every day is ADS-CFT, which is mostly conjecture, okay, that is basically related to theories, okay? So again, that duality is trying to connect a theory that is a quantum theory in four dimensions to some, you know, ADS, anti-de Sitter, 5, cross S5, whatever, okay, theory, string theory, gravity theory, sorry. And indeed, I mean, it's the same idea. Okay, there might be some mapping that relates it to things. So, and people in this field, you know, in this field of string theory, they are working very hard to try to basically get this type of reality. Now, indeed, as I said, all these things here have absolutely nothing to do with exact solutions. I mean, this is, you know, as we will see, it's not exactly a symmetry. It can be related to symmetry, okay? But indeed, it's something that does not require any exact solvability of the problem, okay? But in some special cases, indeed, dualities help to solve certain problems. I just mentioned the case of the Kita-Ekta-Rykov model, but indeed, I mean, we have worked recently with Sohar Nusinov on looking at exact solutions of the, that, by the way, it was known, it's not that it was not known, this thing, but using similar ideas, okay, that the ones I will present here, to solve this model in the very back of the envelope, okay, the Kanikov model in different topological sectors, by just by using the concept I will introduce upon the rest, okay? So it's straightforward. You don't need to do any weird thing. Now, other reasons is, indeed, I mean, if you're someone that is trying to simulate something, just using Monte Carlo or whatever, and you take any of these quantum field theories, you would like to find many times, you know, very simple classical actions. And it turns out that many times by doing these dual transformations, you can go to another quantum model that after you lift, okay, to the classical theory, is much simpler. So you find simpler classical actions that you can simulate. So there is also an aspect which is practical. Okay, it's not just theoretical. Moreover, I can go farther here and say that indeed these dualities can be used in numerical simulations and some constraint in the way, okay, you are simulating the thing. So you incorporate in your simulations the duality. A very good example that is not known because it's not in the literature, in the normal literature, is that if you take the very simple, you know, IC model in a transverse field and you do real space normalization group for this particular quantum problem. If you just do the naive thing, okay, that wasn't in the 70s, okay, where you reblock things in the usual and most naive thing that you would imagine, it turns out that you don't get the exact critical point. It turns out you don't get the exact critical exponent for the correlation length. But if you do it in a smart way, just keeping the duality, you get both exact. Okay, so many times just keeping this type of, it's not a symmetry as we will see, this type of duality, it turns out you can do better simulations, okay? And then another thing that I'm not going to talk about because it's a question mark, but I've been thinking also lately, is, I mean, if this kind of thing can help, again, towards understanding where the power of quantum computation is. So there are many reasons why one should be interested in this duality. Now, let's put some examples, because, of course, I mean, there are zillions of examples in the literature. So let's go to the old ones. Let's start with the classical dualities, and then you will see that indeed they look like completely uncorrelated problems, okay? So what is the wisdom that is behind this? The normal wisdom in statistical physics is that there is a low temperature to high temperature relation. So it's like there is a model, okay, that is at low temperature, there is a low temperature phase, and there is another model whose phase at high temperatures is related to the low temperature phase of that model. That's the wisdom, and that's basically the Kramers-Vanier duality. But let me give you another kind of wisdom, that is what we already know, okay, just from second year or third, well, I could say second year of undergraduate study, what is the classical electromagnetic duality. Okay, so if we take classical Maxwell equations, okay, and we just write Maxwell equations in vacuum, it turns out that there is a very nice property, okay, that is that if you have a solution that is an electric field E and B, it turns out that there is an equivalent solution. That means that you change E to minus B and B to E, and they are indeed completely equivalent. Okay, that's trivial. Now, as soon as you put matter, the only way you can keep this type of duality is by just putting monopoles. This was known already. You take Jackson. Jackson is discussing this. Okay, so second year of undergraduate, this thing is. Now, let's go Kramers-Vanier quickly. Okay, in Kramers-Vanier, you start with a model in two dimensions. Okay, this is the IC model, the usual IC model, which has a Hamiltonian, a classical Hamiltonian, let's say with bonds, sigma I, sigma j, okay, and with some coupling k that is basically equals to the J coupling, the exchange coupling divided by KT, okay, where T is the temperature. Okay, now, as you will read everywhere, I mean, this model, this partition function here for this model, has a property of self-duality. And what does it mean? Okay, what it means is you will see that, oh, there is a relation between the partition function of the IC model at a certain coupling with the partition function of a model that has exactly become the same Hamiltonian, but in terms of dual variables, with a coupling K star. Okay? So you can connect, and up to these correction terms here, that these correction terms are terms which are regular, okay, they have no singularities even in the thermodynamic limit, it turns out that you can say that at the self-dual point, that is when, you know, K is equal to K star, it turns out that you find the critical temperature. Exactly at this point is where the phase transition happens, because you have one phase at high temperature that can be connected to low temperature, vice versa, okay? And it turns out that if there is a critical point, it should happen exactly at the same point, because these partition functions are exactly the same, and they should have the singularity at the same point. Now, remember this equation here. That's the equation that relates basically the direct coupling to the dual coupling, okay? It's a very weird relation. I mean, it's very well known in the literature, but it's a very weird relation, and this is indeed the famous Cramer-Soignier duality, and this is what this article by Savitz said, that, well, we will consider things that are like transformations, like the Cramer-Soignier. Okay, so this is partition function, partition function. There are no quantum Hamiltonians or anything here. Okay, now, and indeed, as I said at the very beginning, you can determine the critical coupling exactly, okay, just by from this relation. You can check. You take Mathematica there, you just put it, and you will see that this is the exact solution of that thing. Okay? So that's beautiful. Quantum duality is completely different thing. Okay? What is the concept here? The concept or the wisdom is that what you do in quantum duality is that you connect a strong coupling to weak coupling. That's what is ADS-CFT. Okay? So you connect a strong coupling theory to a weak coupling theory. So if you have the solution of your phase or your problem, whatever, at weak coupling, you can connect to another theory at a strong coupling and vice versa. That's what is the wisdom. Let's put the standard example that you will find everywhere in the textbook. The standard example is, let's take the one-dimensional IC model in a transverse field, like this, where you have basically sigma-C interactions, nearest neighbors, and then you have an external transverse field, sigma xi, and it turns out that you can perform a transformation, and they write it down directly, a transformation that you get scared the first time you see it, because how is that you can figure out how to write these variables and then say that you map this Hamiltonian to this other Hamiltonian? It's not obvious just by looking. Of course, I mean, you work it out, and it's simple calculation, but, you know, it's not obvious. So the point is that from this transformation, what you have accomplished is basically take one model with couplings JH, and you have exchanged the couplings. Okay, so exactly at the point, so that's the reason why the concept is a strong coupling with coupling. Okay, so the point is that the point J equals to H, that's a self-dual point, this is where the phase transition happens, the quantum phase transition happens. Okay, so as I said here in words before, indeed, I mean, you have to guess. It looks like you have to guess. If I give you another problem, quantum problem, I mean, it's not easy to figure out what kind of non-local transformation in the microscopic degrees of freedom I have to write. Now, let me give you another view now of something that indeed I was surprised the first time I thought myself. And, you know, I've been working in condensed matter already for many years, decades, okay? And I've been always using the phonon Hamiltonian to death. Okay, it's harmonic oscillator to death. And I never realized it has also duality, okay, very trivial duality. I never realized, indeed. These things are known, by the way. I didn't know, okay? Let me just say. So let me just put this kind of thing in the context of particle wave duality, another kind of context where duality appears, okay, particle wave duality. So basically, our intuition about quantum motion, I mean, it has to do with the fact that, you know, there is a Heisenberg-centered relation that implies, you know, if they have some particle wave, whatever, with, you know, position x and p, they satisfy this commutation relation. But this is trivial. And you see quantum. It's trivial to say that if that particle has a definite momentum, basically what you would have basically is a wave, okay, a plane wave, let's assume, okay, particular state. But if the particle has a definite position, indeed, it will be localized in space, and you know it will be some sort of delta function working. Okay, now in principle, both pictures are incompatible because of this particular uncertainty relation. Okay, so if you have this, I mean, which has definite momentum, it cannot have a definite position. This is, I mean, all standard. Now let me assume I now do the following thing. I just convert x prime to minus p and p prime to x. This is very reminiscent of the classical electromagnetic duality of the Maxwell equation, right? It's very, very simple. So this still satisfies this commutation relation passive. Okay, it's exactly the same commutation relation. I'm not changing anything. So and indeed, you can show this is a unit transformation. I mean, the surprising thing is that, you know, that's the only information I have on my system. I mean, these two things are completely different because I have exchanged basically position with momentum. So in principle, I cannot distinguish between position and momentum, mathematically speaking. I will explain now. Of course, you can basically say what is the difference because you have to basically define what is the Hamiltonian of your system. And when you define the Hamiltonian of your system, I mean, your dynamics basically is breaking that equivalence. That's of course, that's physics. Okay, but this is what is breaking the equivalence. Okay, now the point is that if you go now to the harmonic oscillator, and this is where I was surprised, it's very trivial statement, it's simple, and it's not written in the textbook on quantum mechanics. I take the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator, I do a duality transformation like the one I just showed you. What I do is I transform this Hamiltonian into this other Hamiltonian. The two Hamiltonians have exactly the same spectrum. It's not a symmetry, but they have exactly the same spectrum. The thing doesn't change. So that's an elementary self-duality relation. And behind this self-duality relation is exactly what is called the tau string in string theory, okay, duality. It's exactly the same thing. There is no difference. Okay, so this theory and this theory has shared exactly the same spectrum, identical spectrum, no difference. Okay. Okay. Now, what are all these things have in common? Okay, I show you different examples from the literature. What is that they have in common? Because the thing that they have in common, indeed, these are all examples of unitary equivalence. It's not obvious to realize from what I show you, but this, all these four examples, you can write down as unitary mappings of something that I will explain to me. Okay, so that's what all these things have in common. Now, so what are dualities? And now what I'm going to do, this was a very long introduction, essentially, okay? What one would like to understand is basically what is the physical content and if there is any connection between classical and quantum dualities. Okay, can we connect the two types of dualities? And of course, one would like to have a mathematical characterization of this duality, which is sharp. Okay, it's mathematically well defined. And one would like to have a method that you can derive those dualities. If I give you a theory, you can figure out whether there is a duality or not. And of course, the most important thing, at least from my perspective, is new applications. Okay, otherwise, I'm not a mathematician. Okay, so new applications is the most important. So what I'm going to talk about basically is it's the work that is in this part. So is there any connection between classical and quantum? Okay, let me make a parenthesis now for a minute and tell you about a very simple technique, okay, which is called Bohn algebra technique, basically that we use to determine, indeed, for example, the exact solution of the Kitaev model, Hanekom model. Okay, so you can solve the Kitaev Hanekom model in one page, okay, if you use a technique I'm going to show you now. Now, what are Bohn algebras? Okay, I am going to explain very, very, very briefly what these things are. So basically, if I give you, now I'm going to start from the quantum world, okay, I will connect the two things at the very end. So if I give you a quantum Hamiltonian, okay, in general, and this is, you know, our limitation, physics limitation, okay, is bit of the sum of quasi-local operators. So I can formally write down any Hamiltonian as a sum of something, okay, of a sum, okay, a linear combination, indeed it's a polynomial in some number of degrees of freedom, okay, polynomial sum of basically a set of operators which are quasi-local. I mean, in the case of the IC model in transfer field, these bonds where sigma zi, sigma zj plus whatever sigma xi, okay, these are these operators, okay? And some couplings, okay, such that this operator here is an Hermitian operator. Now, what is a bond algebra? A bond algebra is nothing else for a Hamiltonian. By the way, the bond algebra depends on the Hamiltonian. The bond algebra is defined by the bonds, and the bonds are these particular operators. The bonds is a very generic name. It's not necessarily a bond in the usual sense. Okay, it can be plaquettes or whatever. It's just making, so we didn't find a better word, so we call it bonds. Okay, so a bond algebra for this Hamiltonian is a set of all linear combinations of the products of this bond. And this algebra here has a lot of information about the Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's a bond algebra. Now, let me now go to some sort of first step in trying to define what a quantum duality is, okay, by using this particular bond algebra concept, okay, and show you some examples. Okay, I think it's more useful to do that. So you can ask a question now. I gave you a Hamiltonian, and each Hamiltonian has a bond algebra associated with it, okay? So the bond algebra depends on the Hamiltonian. That's an important thing. So I want to emphasize the fact that duality mappings are not necessarily equal to Jordan-Bigner-like mappings. It's not the same. Jordan-Bigner-like mappings, like, for example, mapping spins one-half to fermions, okay, or hardcore bosons, or anions, or whatever, okay, those mappings are mappings of algebras of languages, okay? Nothing else. It's not Hamiltonian dependent. Dualities will be Hamiltonian dependent transformations. So the bond algebra has information on the Hamiltonian. That's important. So now I ask, when are two Hamiltonians dual to each other? So I would say that H1 and H2, these two Hamiltonians, are dual to each other if there is an isomorphism between their bond algebras. Okay? And we will see what that those fancy words mean in a minute, okay? So, and indeed, dualities are a one-to-one onto mappings between bond algebras that preserve every algebraic relation between bonds. So I can map one bond, I mean, elements of the bond algebra to another one, okay, in a unitary fashion. We will see in a minute. Now, self-dualities, so there are dualities and self-dualities. Self-dualities are automorphisms of the bond algebra that preserve the form of the Hamiltonian. So if I have, now, this is the case of the IC model in a transverse field. When we perform the transformation, this non-local transformation, we preserve the form. We just change the couplings. But the form of the Hamiltonian was exactly the same. There was no difference at all. Indeed, the self-duality, another way of saying the same thing, is the self-duality is a symmetry of the bond algebra. Now, quantum mechanics requires these mappings to be unitary implementable. Now, the unitary implement, yes. Okay.
Operators, if all the changes is the value of the coefficients?
What it changes is this. Remember this Hamiltonian we have here. For example, this Hamiltonian, okay? Doesn't matter. Okay, now, this is a Hamiltonian called JH, for example. Okay, now, I will write another Hamiltonian that it turns out that, you know, I mean, I write it in terms of the dual variable. The dual variable satisfies the same algebra, so it doesn't matter. I can call with the same name or with tilde. Okay, there is basically another model that, let me put tilde if you want to differentiate. Another model here where I exchange the couplings, okay? These are the same operators. It's not different, these operators, it is. I exchange the couplings, okay? So it's preserving the form. The bond algebra is larger, but when I do the unitary map, it turns out that I'm not adding other operators to the Hamiltonian.
So is there an underlying assumption that the Hamiltonian is a sum of these elements of the bond algebra?
Of the bond algebra, yes. That's what I wrote. It's a sum over R, J, R, O, R.
Right.
Yes.
But, I mean, in order to check that, the Hamiltonian has an tent in the structure.
It's what?
The Hamiltonian has an tent in the structure in this sense.
Yes.
And you have to look beyond the algebra, right? I mean, you are not just looking, I mean, if I recall the definition of the algebra, there is more structure there than just the isn't there?
Of course. Of course, I mean, but this is what defines the reason why it's a symmetry of the bone algebra. That's what defines precisely the subduality. In general, you are not going to accomplish this. When you do any of these maps and you go from one magnitude to another, it's not going to happen this. Only very peculiar very peculiar theories have this property. Okay?
No.
Yeah.
I will ask.
Okay. Okay. Just wait and you will see in a minute, you know, some examples. So let's put very, very brief examples of things that we know in some way or another. For example, we have this planar orbital compass model, okay, where you have a spins 1/2, which are defined on the vertices of this lattice here. And it turns out that along a certain direction, let's say the x direction, you have interactions which are the four sigma xi, sigma s, pi plus e1. This is the e1 direction, this is the e2 direction. And along this direction, you have sigma y, sigma y. So you have sigma y, sigma y, sigma y, sigma y, sigma y, sigma y, sigma y. That's one of the examples, you know, where you have topological order. Okay, this is a topological order system. Now, there is an obvious self-duality in this problem, so I can have a unitary map which exchanges these things. I'm not caring about that. I'm looking for a different one. And the one I'm looking for is precisely the one that corresponds to the Schumer Hamiltonian, which is a Hamiltonian defined on a completely the same lattice, okay, but it's a completely different type of interaction. So what you have are spins on the vertex of a lattice, but what you have are essentially either plaquette interactions between the spins, or you have external fields on the vertex. Okay, the others were bonds, in the usual sense of bonds. These are plaquettes and external fields. Okay, well, now, these two models, indeed, are dual. They share exactly the same spectrum. They are identical. They are not different. They are exactly the same models. Okay, these two models are dual because you can find a unitary map that maps these bonds, for example, to these plaquettes, and these bonds to this, and you preserve all the bond algebra. It's identical. You cannot differentiate one from the other. So these are unitary equivalent models, okay? That means they have exactly the same spectrum, okay? No difference. So you can solve one or you can solve the other. If you go to the computer, you will get exactly the same thing. It's the same model, okay? So another example that is an old example for those of you that are in topological order, indeed, is the Kitaev model. That's the way we came out to this concept of thermal fragility. Basically, we start with the Kitaev model where you have now the spins 1/2 defined on the links now, on the bonds here, okay? And you have plaquette interactions, which are defined essentially by these terms here, B terms, and then you have also star interactions, which are defined over this vertex, like here, AS. Now, doing one of these unitary maps, you can show that this model is identical to two uncoupled chains. Identical, same spectrum, everything the same. Or you can do another duality mapping and you go to the Wentz plaquette model. Identical, the same, no difference. All these models are the same model, okay? They share exactly the same spectrum. Now, from here, it was not obvious to see how to get the partition function at finite temperature. From here, you just go to any textbook on statistical mechanics, undergraduate, and tells you how to do it. Okay? Now, let's go now to our old friend of the ICA model and transfer field again. But now let's look from the point of view of the bone algebra. Okay? From the point of view of the bone algebra, let me write down again here, okay, that Hamiltonian. So we have a spins 1/2 on this lattice here. And now I'm going to call this a bond, and I'm going to call this a bond. So let's look at the bond algebra. What happens with the bond algebra? What happens is this. Every sigma sigma c bond anticommutes. This anticommutes with two sigma x. Okay? They anticommute this because they are sharing one of them at sigma x and sigma z. They anticommute. So these bonds here anticommute with the bonds here. The same here, and so on and so forth. So every bond sigma x anticommutes with two bonds sigma z. So this anticommutes with these two bonds sigma z. Okay? So the role of sigma x or sigma z, they look different, but it's the same from the point of view of the structure of the bond algebra. Okay? It's exactly the same. It's not different. So indeed, you can do an automorphism where your map, for example, this is the dual lattice. I am given the same index I. You can put the index you want. Okay? It doesn't matter. But that's a dual lattice, that's a lattice. What I'm doing is I map sigma xi to sigma z here,
or I map sigma c to sigma sigma xi minus 1 here. Okay? I do this particular, this mapping is unitary. You can write the unitary that is performing this mapping. I do this mapping, and it turns out that the only thing I've done is to exchange j and h. Okay? Nothing else. The two models are exactly the same. Indeed, I find this unitary that is performing this transformation from one lattice to the viewer one, and the same thing with the other one. Okay? So this model is self-dual in the sense that if I do this unitary over this Hamiltonian in JH, I go to a Hamiltonian that is HJ. Notice that the fact that it's a unitary transformation, similarity transformation is unitary, means that you conserve the spectrum. But it's not a symmetry. It's only a symmetry at the self-dual point. The Hamiltonian does not commute in the usual sense of it, okay? Does not commute with a symmetry, okay? So the commutator of this is not the same. You have exchanged things, okay? So the typical wisdom you will see in the literature is that dualities are symmetries. This is not true, okay? It's not true that a duality is a symmetry. The square of a duality is a symmetry, okay?
It's not always true. Yes, of course. It's not always true. That's correct. Now, this is a very clear example, okay, the one I showed you.
But it turns out that just looking, you know, algorithmically, it provides a way of systematic way of searching for this, because you look at the symmetry of this one algebra. Okay, I will tell you now in a second how to derive these non-local dual operators that before were guessed in the past. They were writing down those operators, and you just check that everything works. But this can be derived. Okay, this can be derived from the algebra. So let me tell you how you do that. Okay, so the first thing you have to observe is that indeed the bond algebraic mapping is local in the bonds. If you see this mapping, it's a local map in the bonds. However, I said the microscopic degrees of freedom are no local. Okay, so it's harder to find no local transformation than to find linear local transformation, right? So the point is that the mapping of this microscopic is no local. So how is that we can go from here to here? Okay, that is the question. Now, how you go is simple. Remember again, now I change, I call dual variables mu, okay, just to make the distinction. Okay, so we go from bonds to dual variables. Let's take the example, mu x equals to this, mu z equals to this. That's a bond algebra map. That's what I did from the unitary mapping from the bond algebra. Okay, I didn't write the elementary degrees of freedom. Now, if I pick up any of these things, okay, and for example, I start multiplying, since there is a square of the thing equals to 1, it turns out that indeed the dual variable is nothing in the string operator, which is this non-local thing that we had before. Now you can say this looks like it's something special of the spin 1/2 problem. No, it's not special. Indeed, whenever the dual variables are in the bond algebra, you will always be able to find a product, okay, of bonds that will give you that operator in the bond algebra. Okay? So this always happens. There are other more, this is a simple case because it's a spin 1/2. The square of a spin 1/2 is 1. But if you take the Peacock model, you take Potts model, whatever, indeed it's not the square equals to 1, and you can do exactly the same thing. So this method allows you, once you discover where is the self-duality, allows you to write down the dual variables. You can write down the dual variables without guessing. Okay? Now, good. Now, we want to relate classical and quantum dualities. Okay? So the obvious way to relate these two things, I mean, in principle, it looks like completely different things, right? One is quantum, the other is classical, or strong coupling, weak coupling. Yeah. No, they are always local in the bonds, because locality is defined by the index of the bond.
Is it by definition they're local, or by a theorem they're local?
No, they are local because we physicists, when we write theories, write it local. That's the reason why local. Local or quasi-local?
Well, the Hamiltonian is local, but why does it follow that the isomorphism, the bound algebra,
because,
must be local?
Because, no, what I'm saying is that the mapping between bonds is local. That's what I'm saying.
But is that a requirement you put?
That's a requirement of transformation, yes.
That's a requirement.
Yes, because I can always perform any unitary map that is not local. These are not the ones I care about. I want to go from a local theory to local theory.
That's a good point.
So the dual, okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. It needs to be from local to local. The bond mapping. Yeah. Now the microscopic variable is now local.
Can you go back one slide, please?
Yes.
I'm not sure I understand the passage with the red arrow. I mean, in this example, I understand. Oh. It's when you say it's true in general. So if I understand that once you have a bond algebra map, there is some product of the bonds that gives you the variables. But it's not always, I mean, you don't have a recipe to understand what product it is.
No.
You show one.
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
But in general, you say, oh, I have an algorithm.
No, it's an existing proof. This is the thing. It's an existing proof. Doesn't mean if I have a theory, you know, a complicated theory in four dimensions or something like that. Okay, the fourth dimensional theory, I will show you, we can do that. Okay, but suppose you have a very complicated, convoluted thing. Doesn't mean that to find the product that will give you the dual variable doesn't take, you know, an exponential time.
Yeah,
it's not obvious.
Because
sure. But it's obvious that there is always existence, that it is, because it's within the bond algebra. So a good question is, can we write an algorithm, a code, okay, that is going to find the thing? The answer is, I don't know how to write in polynomial time. Probably it's exponential.
Yeah,
in this case,
I agree with it. If the mapping in your variables is just the product of the generators of the algebra.
That's right. That's the point. That's the whole thing. That's the whole thing. But you see, this recipe we are giving of bond mappings, I mean, this is exactly how to solve, I mean, the reason why people were going around and writing 70 pages or whatever to solve the Hannicutt model, because everyone is looking at the local microscopic variable. And they are not looking at the bonds. Because when you look at the bonds, it's trivial to solve the problem. People usually look at the elementary degree of freedom.
I'm very curious to see, because from the method point of view, I mean, finding what are the dual variables, the actual dual variables is very complex, right? You cannot find the
dual. If you give me an arbitrary problem that I don't know, all the ones I have solved, you can do it. Now, I agree that if you give me a very arbitrary one, I do not see in principle how to write an algorithm that is polynomial and is going to find this particular dual variable. That's just my answer. There is an algorithm, but it's exponential, I would say, in principle. That's what I would say. Okay? But it is there, that's what I'm saying. It is in the algebra. Okay, indeed, these are the generators of kings. I forgot to say that, okay? Okay, let me now connect the two things. So I want to connect classical and quantum dualities because in principle the things completely unconnect the thing. The most obvious way to do, indeed, is basically through finite path integrals. So that's the obvious idea, okay? But that's not the usual way, you know, things are done, indeed. You know, if you go to any literature, you will have the derivation of the Kramers-Vanier in the classical case, which is a very complicated thing in terms of, you know, loop expansions, high temperature, low temperature series expansions, connecting the loops, going back and there. And then you have the other derivation that is guessing the dual variables. You see it works. Two things seem uncorrelated. It's magic. The two things I'm going to show you is exactly the same thing. Okay? It's a trivial connected thing. And what I'm going to show you is to the Feynman path integral. Okay? So the idea is basically that what we propose is that these two things are identical. And you can connect, you can go from one to the other, okay? And indeed, it's easier to characterize the dualities or self-dualities in the quantum case. It's easy, okay? So let me now to go to how do I show the Kramers-Vanier duality in three lines, the original one, okay? So I start from this model that we know that there is a very trivial, okay, mapping. Unitary mapping that basically exchanges two things, and there is a self-duality here. I know. So what I do is I use the usual Feynman path integral. So I go from this quantum problem in d dimensions, in this case one, to another classical problem in two dimensions, d plus one. So when I do that,
indeed, I go to something that looks like the IC model, and there are these couplings that are defined in terms, basically, of, you know, the time slices or whatever you are performing in your packing. Okay? So this is a standard. There is nothing weird. Now, indeed, we can fine-tune these couplings, okay, in such a way that we get exactly the classical IC magnet. And to do that, I mean the same couplings in one direction and in the other. And to do that, indeed, I realized that the K coupling that appears here is nothing else than the logarithm of the tangent of Hm, of the Hm that I defined before. And this should be equal to Jm, that is the Jm I defined before. Okay? So I take the IC model, I do the Feynman mapping, and I realize that these couplings are related in this way, and then I get the classical IC model, the isotropic classical IC model. Now, suppose now I know that there is a symmetry in the quantum problem. Now I change. I change the coupling, okay, J and H. And I do the same process. Obviously, I will get now a new coupling that is same form, functional form, but Jm exchanged with Hm, because this is coming from the quantum phase. Any connection between these two things? Of course. The connection is the fact that, you know, the partition functions, I mean, these two things are equal, okay, indeed dictates this condition. That is the thing I wrote down at the very beginning, okay, as a Kramers-Vanier. Okay, and indeed, if you work out the relations I gave you before, implies that this hyperbolic sine of 2k times sine hyperbolic of 2k hat equals to 1, before I wrote k star. Okay? So basically, knowing that there is a duality at the quantum level leaves you to a duality at the classical level, and it's exactly the same thing, but manifests different. Okay? So, notice this point, this very simple point, contrast. Quantum self-duality, H equals to J, is a self-dual point. Classical self-duality relation is this thing here. This looks a very complicated function. This is a trivial thing. That's a common, extremely common thing. Okay, so what you realize is that it's extremely hard to see when it's in a classical statistical case, okay, classical statistical mechanics, partition function. You have things that are very complicated to figure out what is the dual relation, if there is any. But quantum mechanical is very simple. Okay, let me skip this thing. So indeed, classical and quantum dualities or self-dualities are equivalent and in correspondence, okay? And indeed, you can unify the two things. They are two sides of the simple. Now, this is a comment about something I already said, that notice, because this is in the literature, duality is not exactly a symmetry, okay? A self-duality is not a symmetry in general. The square of a self-duality is a symmetry. Indeed, one could say, if one likes to use, you know, this kind of, I don't know, boxy kind of thing, is that the self-duality is a square root of a quantum symmetry, basically. Okay? This has no meaning, mathematical meaning, but it's fancy and it's nice, you know, for this kind of physics today or whatever. Okay? So, indeed, a self-duality is an immersion symmetry at the self-dual point. That's true. So at the self-dual point, you have an immersion symmetry that is a self-duality. Now, by the way, notice that U squared can be a symmetry. Now, UQ is not necessarily going back to U or to 1 or anything like that. We have models, like the peak-block model, that you continue until U to the fourth. You do not come back to 1. So U squared is a symmetry that is highly non-local, and you cannot see just by looking at the Hamiltonian. So this way of thinking can give you really symmetries which are highly non-local in your Hamiltonian. It's not obvious. Yes?
Last slide. You have a double arrow. But if I find the quantum symmetry, it's not necessarily the case that taking the root of that leaves a Hamiltonian that just has a change of parameters.
Of course, no. No. I have said, that's the reason why I said, this is the kind of thing that, it's a kind of conceptual thing that everybody is saying. Self-duality is a symmetry. This is what you will see the words. I'm saying, no, it's like a square root of a symmetry. Okay? But it has no mathematical meaning more than what I said here. Because that's a real mathematical statement.
I guess I would say that's a good slogan if you had an arrow that just pointed to the right. Every time you have a self-duality, it implies, you know, that if you square it...
I agree 100%.
Okay,
good. I agree 100%. I agree.
Thanks.
I really understand what you said. Okay, now,
I can give you a series of examples, okay? All known examples of dualities, and dualities that have been proved dualities, okay? Not non-proved dualities, okay? Of the proved dualities, you can cast in this language. Okay? So, and you can basically get, but why would say, why should we bother if we can, you know, we are solving what everyone solved. Well, I will show you that this way allows you to go beyond. That's the whole point. Otherwise, there is no point in staying here. Okay, yeah, it's a very nice way of looking at the thing, but as usual, we would like to do something new. Okay? So now we are going to enlarge the zoo of these realities. Okay? That's part of the idea. And I pick up basically one example that had a certain impact indeed in high energy, I mean, in lattice gauge theory. That is a case of a four-dimensional Euclidean lattice with gauge fields which are abelian. Okay, and this goes back to this tooth idea about confining the confining phase transition. Basically, in order to understand, you know, this quark confinement thing, basically, you should go, I mean, to the center of SUN that is the N. Okay? So basically, you can write down, there is a minus one here missing, okay? That doesn't matter. So you can basically define the classical action of the things, okay? These are the Wilson action for these theories. That is basically the real part of the trace of this particular product that corresponds to have gauge fields on the links here now. These are not spins, these are, you know, gauge fields. And basically, you take the product of this gauge field with a certain orientation, okay, for this link. That's the reason we have U dagger. And basically, that defines the theory. Okay, and now you would like to know what is the phase diagram of the theory, and you would like to know whether there is a self-duality or not in the theory. Okay? Now, the recipe I told you, by the way, this problem was solved, numerically there are simulations, okay? I mean, this problem is not exactly solved, by the way. But this problem has been simulated with Monte Carlo already in the 80s, 90s, simulated with Monte Carlo, and indeed was not simulated in any quantum formulation. It was simulated in four dimensions, okay? So basically with Euclidean action. That's the way this model was solved. And indeed, there have been all kinds of discussions about what the phase diagram is, whether there are, you know, the Higgs phases, abelian phase, Coulomb phases, disorder confined phases. But the point is that there was a conjecture that essentially, if you have n, if this is Cn, the n of z, okay, n is larger or equal to 5, there is no self-duality. As I said, they were working the classical action, and it's extremely hard to figure out whether there is something or not. I will show you now that there is a self-duality for any n, okay? But you have to do what I'm going to tell you now to see that this self-duality. So we go back now from this Euclidean action to the quantum Hamiltonian formulation, where now this quantum Hamiltonian is defined in three dimensions. We start with four dimensions, we go to three dimensions. So using the Feynman map, inverse, okay? So indeed, that's a way also the IC model has been solved by Lipschultz and Mack is going from, you know, two dimensions to one plus one. It's doing the similar kind of thing. But here we are going from four dimensions to three dimensions. Now, this Hamiltonian now is a more complicated object. The more complicated object is that you have these matrices, which are defined on the vertices, okay, and you have these other matrices here, which are products of what are U matrices. Now, let me explain what this is. I mean, it's a very technical thing, but let me explain the mathematics of this is beautiful. Okay, it turns out that this has never been written, okay? It turns out that these matrices here, okay, are precisely on side, on each side, are the matrices that form the bilateral. Beautiful mathematics, okay? So, and of course, these are not things that commute or anything like that, okay? They have this omega, which are basically the nth root of one, okay? So, so what we have done so far is just convert the original four-dimensional problem into a quantum three-dimensional problem with some coupling here that is coming basically from
yeah. So this is the quantum Hamiltonian for the previous classical
yes.
model.
Yes.
The way without an external field.
No. This is the model.
Yeah. So there is no external field.
No.
It's only the
pure gauge theory.
Okay.
That's not. These are not matter fields. This is not Higgs. Okay. There is no Higgs field or anything like that.
So this one, when you go to the quantum as two types of terms.
Yes.
Because I can see, the theta is basically the spatial part, right? So this is on the.
This is connected to the. This is like in the IC model when you leave sigma c along this row here.
Yeah.
But now you see we have like three dimensions and we are putting another dimension the fourth time. And we are mapping back. So this is like going like here, and then the other dimension gives you an external field, which is the C5X, is this object here.
And I guess you have these plaquettes in space-time. Like the second term is those which are purely spatial, I suppose.
Because
the first term is to reproduce the plaquettes that are mixed.
Exactly, which are in the other, the fourth dimension.
Oh, in the fourth dimension.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's easier to see in two dimensions, okay, than to see in four, okay? But the whole point I want to make here is that it turns out that these matrices here satisfy a very nice algebraic structure, which is the Bayes algebra, okay, which is very nice, mathematically friendly, okay? And indeed, I don't want to say more about what I say now, because this is still under study. It's that, you know, there is a very deep connection between Fourier transform on groups and these kind of things, okay? But I want to stop there. So basically, the way to see
these self-duality mappings in pictorially, okay, what we can do now, we have this quantum Hamiltonian, and why we want to see whether there is one of these isomorphic mappings that leaves the Hamiltonian invariant, okay. And it turns out that, I mean, pictorially, what we have to do is take, for example, if this is the three-dimensional lattice, each of these points is a point in the lattice. I'm not plotting all the points, okay, just a few, okay. But this is one of the points of the lattice. So basically, what we have to do is to map every V here to some other, for example, V1 to theta 1, V2 to theta 2 with these indices, V3 to theta 3, and at the same time, the thetas to the Vs like here. Okay, so we do this kind of algebraic mapping, and we map one Hamiltonian to the dual. From mapping the same Hamiltonian with the dual, means I change the coupling. When I do that, okay, I basically get a self-dual relation, and I can get a self-duality equation that no one derived that tells me basically what are the self-dual couplings, and in some cases they are the critical couplings for n equals 2, 3, and 4, and for n equals larger than 5, is a self-dual coupling because basically the phase diagram is something like that. Okay, it's something like if you have temperature here, and this is n, let's say up to n equals to 4, this is 4, you have basically two phases. This is like some sort of icing phase, the equivalent of the icing phase. Right now, you see, with can be three states and not two necessarily. So this is like the icing phase, and this is like a paramagnetic phase. But then from here on, this splits, okay, and there is an intermediate phase here, which is the Kuhnow phase.
Yes, exactly. So the self-duality
you can't deduce the critical temperature.
Pardon?
So you can no longer deduce the critical temperature.
That's a good point. That's another thing. That's a very good point. So the self-dual temperature is going through here. And now the question is how, if you can say, I can say many things from the self-dual relation, but I cannot, because otherwise, I can determine, for example, the critical temperature of the XY model in two dimensions, the causal Lifalis transition exactly. Okay? It's just if you, because I think you understand what I'm talking about. So the point is, I cannot do that. I cannot do that, and I don't know why yet. Okay? So that's a mystery for me so far. But the thing is, the important thing is that indeed, this self-dual structure, I didn't write down the analytic expression, okay? I didn't write down the analytic expression. We derive an analytic formula. It's in the paper, okay? It's an analytic formula that the limit n goes to infinity related to Bessel functions. Okay, it's an analytic formula giving all the self-dual points, everything, okay? So, indeed, this is telling me that it's self-dual for any a, okay? But it's hard to figure out in the classical model that it's self-dual when you pass here. You cannot figure out. Indeed, what I can do now is take the quantum self-duality, lift again, and I get exactly the self-duality there at the classical level, like the sine hyperbolic is 2k. I get the classical, and it's an extremely complicated function. So you cannot figure out, but at the quantum level, you figure out where it is. Indeed, another thing we have proved by doing this is that the self-dual structure of this model, of this CN gauge field theories, are exactly the same as the vector post model. And this was a question that everyone in lattice gate theory were trying to answer for a long time, because they were seeing that they were getting similar kind of temperatures, critical temperatures numerically, but they could not figure out. They said, okay, this looks like the post model, but we don't know why. Of course, I have solved, I didn't show you, the post-model, and it is exactly the same structure. It's the same equation. Okay? So the algebraic structure, the UR structure of the CL gauge field theory is identical to the vector post-model in two dimensions. This is a theory in four dimensions. But the self-field structure, which is the symmetry of the Monash, is the same. Okay? Another important thing for those that understand about what I'm talking about, we never use the Villain string. This is the only way everyone is solving the things when they can. Villain string means take all these weird matrices there and basically take the square, the harmonic part of that thing. It's an approximation, okay, to this action. We are solving the action directly. We are not doing any approximation, okay?
Okay. Okay, I have to stop here, and I will tell you basically what we have accomplished, okay? If there are more questions, I will answer, no problem. So basically, what we accomplished at these quantum self-dualities now I think can be looked at systematically as Bohn algebra unitary mappings. The fact that it's unitary is crucial, because the fact that it's unitary allows me to connect the quantum with the classical. Imagine, roughly speaking, I have a Hamiltonian, I have a U, I have a partition function that is a trace. The U, I can, you know, the invariance, the cyclic invariance of the trace. Then the U doesn't play any role. And then I can lift and you map one duality to the other. The fact is, U is unitary. That is something that people didn't realize. All these are unitary mapping. That's the reason why you can connect things. And you can connect spectra. Okay? Now, this algebraic approach basically explains classical dualities as well, as I said before, in any space dimension. This has nothing to do with the space dimensionality. It's the Bohn algebra, okay? The dual variables can be computed, okay? And they carry, and this is where we are working still, carry information on the topological excitations of the system. We would like to classify the excitations just by looking at the dual variables, okay? That's important. We have skirmions, we have vortices, we have what? How is that we can topologically classify those excitations by looking at the duality? We have not solved the problem, but it's something that is we are working. Now, you can discover new self-dualities. Something I didn't talk about here, indeed, that you can talk also about immersion duality. That's another concept, that it's emerging. Not, it's not the problem of the full Hamiltonian, but of the projected Hamiltonian in a certain sector. For example, there's a model I didn't show here, quantum dimer model, that in a quantum dimer model, it turns out that the ground state, you can show an emergence duality. And the ground state sector is not a higher state sector, but the ground state sector, you can flip the things. Okay? Well, in some cases, indeed, allows exact solution, this kind of mappings, but this is special. When you have exact solution, it's special. This is not, indeed, another important subject of research is when you have a self-dual structure, when is it? What's the connection between the self-duality and exact solvability? I don't know the answer. Okay, but that's another thing. And indeed, you know, we have solved, you know, many other cases which are not in the paper, but we are writing a longer paper. Many other ones. I mean, you can write down all these duality. So with this, I will stop because I have very fast time. Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
Can you use the idea that the square root of self-duality is a symmetry to define a self-duality? So can you say that the self-duality is an involution of the bond algebra that is unitary?
So what I said is, it's interesting. When you have a symmetry, okay, when you have a symmetry in your problem, okay, the symmetry does not imply that you have a duality, okay? It does not imply that thing. But when you have a symmetry, it's something local, something like, not all symmetries are local. What I'm saying is that the advantage here of this thing is that if you have a non-local symmetry, indeed for this model U squared is the symmetry. A non-local symmetry, if you have a duality, is easy to see, okay? But I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I mean, yeah.
So previously you defined self-duality as an automorphism of a Bond algebra that preserves the form of the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And that seems very vague. So I was wondering if, because the statement that the square root of a self-duality is a symmetry is very precise. means if you do it twice, you get that consistent Hamiltonian.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you can use that for the definition.
Oh, yes.
OK.
Yeah, sure. Sorry.
I'm not completely sure of what I'm going to say, but it seems to me that each time you had Hamiltonian that only depended on two parameters, for example, J and A, what happens if you take more than two parameters?
That's the same question.
Consider any permutation of the parameter.
That's another consequence of what I said. Okay. Typically, people were talking about strong coupling with coupling because everyone was looking at two parameters.
Yes.
People didn't know. Okay, you are to have competition of two type of orders, and let's look at this. I mean, I do the same thing. Okay, but in what I'm saying, indeed, does not preclude that you can have basically exchange of parts of the Hamiltonian. You can have three terms. For example, three type of terms. Let's call, for example, alpha one something here. Let me write the case. Okay, let me write the case. Alpha one plus alpha two plus alpha three. And it's not precluded, you can exchange two, but not the other one.
Yes, but then you could also have things, for example, a permutation of three of them, which are not dualities, because this, which are not conventional dualities.
Yes, exactly. They are not conventional dualities, but you can have this.
Because it's not the square, but the cube of the duality.
Exactly. That's a good observation. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's a good observation. Yeah, what I have said has nothing to do. What I said is not constrained to two parameters. That's the whole thing. I mean, the literature is putting two parameters because of history. I don't know. But in what I'm saying, it doesn't matter.
Can this be extended to cases where you have a non-abelian structure?
Ah, that's a very good question. OK, that's a very good question. That's a million-dollar question. Now. You can, in principle, extend to non-abelian cases. There are not many examples. Maybe you can give me some examples if you know others. There are not many examples of proof, not conjecture, non-abelian dualities. Okay. Part of the story with that is that I've been a little bit confused, and we've been discussing, you know, with my collaborators and my students, basically, what's the meaning of a non-abelian duality? What is the meaning of that thing? What does it mean that a non-abelian duality is what? A non-abelian duality is it's related to the fact that there is a symmetry in the Hamiltonian that is non-abelian, and there is a duality is what? Indeed, it's not that. Because you can see the example of the, for example, the Potts model, for p equals 3, there is a non-abelian, there is S3, the permutation group of three elements, which is non-abelian, okay? However, the duality is abelian, right? Now, so that means that you can find an abelian duality that is solving a problem that has a non-abelian symmetry. Now, so the minimal requirement to have a non-abelian duality is essentially to have a non-abelian symmetry. But that's not mean that if you have a non-abelian symmetry, you may have a non-abelian duality, okay? Having said that, I said that we have not so far figured out, okay, in a true non-abelian case, true non-abelian duality in the sense I'm talking about, how to find new dualities. If you have some example we can work out, we will work out. But we have not found anything. We are, of course, working on that. I suspect there is maybe some connection to some sort of hidden subgroup thing in quantum information, but this, you forgot what I said. I don't know. I'm sorry, in a way, but
I think the main reason it doesn't work in this way is that the group of representations of an abelian group is abelian. That's actually what you're really using here. And that doesn't work for non-abelian.
No, in principle, it has nothing to do because, I mean, you can have these non-abelian bone algebras. I mean, that's fine.
No, but, I mean, in your comment, you said that you do this Fourier analysis on the...
That's something else. That's, but I guess, say anything else, yeah.
That's the core.
Yeah. But I didn't say anything about that. Well, I just said the words. I'm not going to expand on that. Okay? So you understand what you're talking about. Yeah.
How would you extend this to the continuum physics?
Oh, well, I mean, the harmonic oscillator is a continuum. There is no problem.
I mean, field theory.
Yes, good, field theory. By the way, I mean, this was a lattice gate field theory, okay? Field theories, I mean, the way we have basically dealt with field theories was basically defining the field theory and the lattice. So we discretize the theory. We take the field theory, we discretize the theory, and then we use, when the theory is discretized, we use the Bohn algebra. And it works for the cases that are known. All cases are known, okay, we could reproduce exactly the duality.
But for an abelian group, you don't need to discretize it. You can do it for electromagnetism.
Yes, by the way, yes. I mean, for QED, the QED non-compact, because Cn, when n goes to infinity, we give you a compact QED, okay? For QED non-compact, indeed, you can write down a similar type of duality without any problem, just using the Bohn algebra I showed. It's in the supplementary material.
The conjecture duality people were think about, I forgot the name, what is it called? Allo, Monton, duality, those kind of things.
Yeah.
You put them on a lattice and then what? Do you see that there is a duality or not?
Yes, I look at the Bohn algebra of this operator.
So you say you proved that this duality...
No, but that's for a non-abelian group. I mean, that's a thing that you're not
proved. For the non-abelian, we have not done yet. That's what I said. The cases of field theories that we did were abelian. That's what I'm saying. But you can do field theory.
And you also said something about spermia. What do you think?
No, but this is basically to classify the things. I mean, this is where I thought. But this is also something we have not accomplished.
So what's the idea?
Well, the idea is basically to take the dual variables. So we build the dual variables. And then from the type of duality, basically...
What's the duality? Are you going to define them?
No, you have a theory.
Yeah.
Yeah. For example, I mean, the case of the AC model, you have a duality. It's a C2.
I know, but the Sperm model, in the Spermian theory, what is the duality?
Oh, no, there is no duality there. No, I'm not talking about the Sperm model. I said Sperm excitations. The Sperm excitations are not necessarily in the Sperm model.
Okay.
I mean, there are many other examples. In condensed matter, we have Sperm in quantum code, ferromagnets. So it's not the Sperm of the Sperm model. Necessarily. Yes.
Could you study the classical dualities in a different way? You define a Bohn algebra in terms of the variables that appear in your Hamiltonian. In your classical Hamiltonian. You define a product in terms of the Poisson bracket. And instead of asking for a connection with a unitary, you say, is there a symplectic transformation that takes
place? That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that thing. I thought about that indeed. Indeed, I think that if there is some connection there, it must be related to the operator algebra of Kalanov. That's what you're talking about. Or probably that's what you're talking about.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah. So Kalanov basically, in renormalization group, a completely different setup, basically defines some sort of operator algebra in terms of the classical variables. I think that, he didn't talk about duality, is it?
No.
He talked about these algebras you're talking about. So, I mean, and I thought, maybe there is indeed some connection. I mean, I'm not saying along the lines of what you said exactly, but you can find some way of mapping those algebras, okay, from one to the other, and you can see there. That's a good question. I don't know yet. I said, there is plenty of there is plenty of space at the bottom, right? We don't know. I mean, this is something that we did very recently, and we are still exploring. So I cannot say more than I don't know yet. But that's a good point.
Okay, so I think if there's no more questions, we can thank Vasari for a great talk.
I am a different.
Yep. So beautiful.